This fact, Douglas wrote in 1855, is shrouded in a mystery I have never been able to penetrate. For the rest of his life, he searched in vain for the name of his true father. In his 1845 narrative, Douglas stated, "My father was a white man, admitted to be such by all I ever heard speak of my parentage. Many in the neighborhood also whispered that my master was my father, but of the correctness of this opinion, I know nothing." By 1855, his father was still definitely a white man or nearly white. Now, however, Douglas said he was no longer giving credence to Aaron Anthony as his father. Douglas claimed that he had reason to think he was not. By the 1881 writing of Life and Times of Frederick Douglass, the author's third autobiography, the paternity dilemma all but vanished with the simple statement, "Of my father, I know nothing." This was never the case for Douglass. The question was deeply important for him, and in 1855 he dwelled at great length on white fathers of slaves. Indeed, he dwelled on Aaron Anthony. "I say nothing of father. Slavery does away with fathers as it does away with families," he wrote. "The order of civilization is reversed here." Then he searched with intensity and descriptive detail for a sense of Anthony's character as the first father figure in his life. Anthony was 51 years old when Frederick Bailey was born, and he owned the adult daughters of Betsy Bailey. But as yet, we have no smoking gun evidence that Anthony is Douglas's natural father. Anthony had two surviving sons in 1818, Andrew and Richard, at ages 21 and 18. They are possible candidates, but with no evidence, even of the hearsay variety, that Douglas grew up with about the elder Anthony. Douglas carefully described the old master as essentially a cruel tyrant, capable of terrible physical and emotional violence, but a man victimized as much by the system of slavery as by his own nature, a theme Douglas repeated as a major part of his autobiographies. He also remembered occasional moments of distracted humanity in Anthony. Most of the time, Anthony paid little, if any, attention to the slave children around the Y plantation yards. He was a busy overseer of the overseers, managing the economic and labor demands of a huge agricultural and commercial enterprise. But on at least one occasion, Douglas remembered old master's affectionate disposition, gently leading me by the hand, as he sometimes did, patting me on the head, speaking to me in soft, caressing tones, and calling me his little Indian boy. Douglas used this almost fatherly act as background for a withering portrait of a smoldering volcano. A brittle, unhappy man of haggard aspect, muttering to himself as he stormed about, cursing and gesticulating at his invisible foes. Born in 1767, Aaron Anthony was the seventh and final child of poor, illiterate farmers from the Tuckahoe Neck, the land immediately across the Tuckahoe River to the east in Caroline County. Douglas later described the poor whites such as Anthony who hailed from there as the lowest order, indolent, and drunken to a proverb. Like Frederick Bailey, Anthony was an orphan, both parents died when he was a child, who made his own way in the world and became a self-made man from extremely humble roots. He loved and managed money well. Like many Eastern shoremen, he also handled boats well, became a seaman, and a captain eventually of the most prominent schooner on Chesapeake Bay, owned and operated by Edward Lloyd. Almost always upwardly mobile, Captain Anthony, as he was often called, married up to Anne Catherine Skinner in 1797, and soon took up residence in a rent-free house on the Lloyd's Y Plantation, as head overseer of some 13 farms, nearly 10,000 acres, and more than 500 slaves. Since he owned Betsy Bailey, as a slaveholder, Anthony likely did not need to buy more slaves of his own. Apart from the 10 children Betsy herself bore from 1799 to 1826, Her five daughters gave birth to at least 20 more among them. By any measure, Anthony was a success story as the manager of the Lloyd slave empire and owner of three large farms of his own that he rented out, at least until after his wife died in 1818, the year Douglas was born. From then until his death in November 1826, Anthony may have descended into mental instability and increased sexual aggression. Douglas famously recorded an incident that gives credence to this image of Anthony as old and angry, lecherous, and violent. Shortly after arriving at the Y House at age 6 and joining the swarm of slave children there, Douglas was asleep early one morning in his normal place, the floor of a rough closet which opened into the kitchen. He was awakened by the shrieks and piteous cries of his 15-year-old aunt, Hester. Anthony had dragged her into the kitchen at dawn, made her strip to the waist, forced her to stand on a bench on her toes as her wrists were tied to a wooden joist above her head. Old Master stood behind Hester, her neck, shoulders, and back entirely naked, an ugly cowskin switch, the lash, in his hand, shouting, D blank D, B blank H, and other epithets too coarse and blasphemous for readers to bear. Little Frederick looked on in horror through cracks in the boards as Anthony adjusted the whip in his hand, steadied his feet for leverage, and dealt one overhand blow after another to the young woman's bleeding neck and shoulder blades. The blood dripped on her clothes and down to the floor. The old man clenched his teeth, gripped the cowskin, and delivered his torture, seemingly delighted with the scene. Embedded in Douglas's rendering of this scene is his broader discussion of Anthony's motives for such a beating. Hester had been seeing a young slave teenager, Ned Roberts, also 15 years old, and Douglas describes both of them as beautiful and attractive young people falling in love. Hester had rejected Anthony's advances and paid dearly for it on that morning. Anthony, Douglas reported, wanted to break up the growing intimacy of the young lovers, but his efforts were to no avail. Douglas turned this episode of his childhood into a parable about the sexual corruption and the spirit-killing immorality at the center of the master-slave relationship. Hester lived with the curse of her personal beauty, and Ned with his almost powerless desire to court and marry her. The jealous Anthony's intentions were abhorrent in every sense, his methods foolish. What slavery so lacked in sexual and familial relations, Douglas offered, was a sense of normalcy, of the peace in which to love freely. Hester should have been free to give her affections to the handsome young man she liked, and Ned free to become a husband. But who or what, asked Douglas, the autobiographer, was this old master? His answer? A tyrant with no bounds. A torturer. A man any civilized society would try and convict for his awful criminality. But alas, Anthony, exhausted from the whipping, wiping off the blood-clotted cowskin, ushered the mangled and weeping Hester out of the kitchen, not knowing that a little boy crouched in a closet, peering in terror at the blood on the floor. Douglas's crafting of the beating of his beautiful young aunt is a former slave's recitation of an overwhelmingly vivid, traumatic memory of a morning in a slave boy's terrible education. It took him many years to understand and find language for the rage that old master's whip and Hester's blood had left in him. If Anthony had been his father, Douglas dearly wanted to know the truth. But more important, he put him to use as a symbol, the sexual predator in the evil system that ruined all decency in humanity. Unforgivingly, Douglas made Anthony into the father of fathers among slaveholders. He turned that haunting whisper of his youth, "Master is your father," into a condemnation of the sexual abuse and its spawn of hundreds of thousands of mulatto children at the heart of slavery in America. The pain of not knowing with certainty the identity of his own father paled, he implied, next to the collective reality he witnessed. The slave status of a child was always that of the mother under American slave law. This arrangement, Douglas declared, admits of the greatest license to brutal slaveholders and their profligate sons, brothers, relations, and friends, and gives to the pleasure of sin the additional attraction of profit. A whole volume might be written on this single feature of slavery as I have observed it. Douglas experienced lasting individual trauma over his roots in this world of rural, lonely, familial, and violent sexual anguish. Few Americans ever more publicly and vividly remade themselves over and over, quite like Douglas, and few had deeper reasons to try. Slavery meant to make him a brute, Douglas wrote. But what man has made, man can unmake. If indeed his 20-year-old mother, still full of flowering beauty, youthful charm, and intelligence, had been raped by the power-besotted, sexually deranged 50-year-old Anthony, Douglas had to find some story or analysis in which to comprehend it as he grew to adulthood. By retrieving his story from memory, he also had to try to dissolve it as he also created it. If he understood that he had not been conceived in love, then he could never know a father's love, although he would seek alternative fathers for much of his life. A man who will enslave his own blood, he insisted, may not be safely relied on for magnanimity. Men do not love those who remind them of their sins, unless they have a mind to repent, and the mulatto child's face is a standing accusation against him who is master and father to the child. Douglas wrote about his paternity with an acute and strategic sense of fatherlessness. Anthony, or whichever white man, pursued Harriet Bailey into her quarters, or in the back of a kitchen in the dark, produced, ultimately, an angry Frederick Douglass, who would find the words to fight back. The extent of slavery's sexual assault on the idea of family, Douglas Riley claimed, was beyond the design of my simple story. Hardly. So much racial mixture had emerged from American slavery, Douglas argued, that if the lineal descendants of Ham are only to be enslaved, according to the scriptures, slavery in this country will soon become an unscriptural institution. For thousands are ushered into the world annually who, like myself, owe their existence to white fathers, and most frequently to their masters and masters' sons. Douglas knew this element of his story was old, complex, and to most, salacious. He told it about as explicitly as he could. The thoughtful, he said, know the rest. In his abolitionist writings and his oratory, Douglas seldom missed an opportunity to convert his story into ways of defining slavery itself to his uninformed audiences. The orphan's anguished story of his roots in Tuckahoe, the parents unknown or vanished, provided the perfect chance to tear out his reader's heart as he bared his own. There is not beneath the sky an enemy to filial affection so destructive as slavery. It had made my brothers and sisters strangers to me. It converted my mother, who bore me, into a myth. It shrouded my father in mystery, and left me without an intelligible beginning in the world. But in such cries in the night, he did tell us a good deal of what remained intelligible in his furtive memory. The first things Douglas did actually know and experience were boyhood memories of life at his grandmother's cabin, the trek to the Y plantation, the Great House farm, and his half-naked, half-starved time as a 7- and 8-year-old at Y, scrounging for morsels of food and affection wherever he could find them. Even deeper, it was from in and around Grandma Betsy's log hut, built of clay, wood, and straw, that Douglas, the adult writer, conjured his first memories. His memory flowed with images of the grandmother's majestic presence, her freshly ironed bandana, how esteemed she was on both sides of the Tuckahoe for her skills in planting and preserving seedling sweet potatoes. As symbol and reality, Douglas gave us the first great yams in African-American literature. Betsy perfected the art of placing the root of the potato at just the right depth and position so it would endure the winter's frosts, a talent for which she was recruited all over the region to assist others, slave and free. Among Douglas's first things was the well outside the cabin, where all the children, too many to count, and almost all his cousins, would play, compete, and scheme. And then there was the simple, if magical, ladder inside the cabin. For Fred Bailey, the ladder up to a makeshift loft was one of those childhood objects or images that zipped in and out of his memory, a really high invention and possessed of a sort of charm. Eating his quick meals of cornmeal with an oyster shell, dashing to and fro and always craving his grandmother's attentions with deep seriousness against the bids of all the other urchins in the yard, and prancing across a cornfield to the busy mill up toward Hillsboro, these memories allowed Douglas to create a self-portrait of a boy in a state of nature. Slave children are children, he instructed his romantic readers. In his earliest years, he could imagine he had been a genuine boy, running wild at times, enacting by turns all the strange antics and freaks of horses, dogs, pigs, and barn door fowls without incurring reproach. This little boy, protected by the seemingly powerful matriarch at that bend in the Tuckahoe, could trot on, as happy as any little heathen under the palm trees of Africa. Or so the story demanded in his brilliant recreation of childhood innocence peculiar to slavery just before the fall, when befuddling rumors of old master's absolute power began to invade his euphoria. Clouds and shadows began to descend on him. He was told that Captain Anthony brought all the slave children at a certain age to his own homestead. Soon, Douglas kept hearing around Grandma Bailey's sanctuary, he would see sights by and by. Chapter 2. A Childhood of Extremes. Extremes meet in mind as in matter. Frederick Douglass, 1855. He remembered it as a beautiful summer morning. Frederick Bailey's world turned upside down on such a morning in 1824. His time had come for removal from the only home I ever had, his grandmother Betsy's cabin, to the Y plantation, and Aaron Anthony's homestead. It would be a day of momentary adventure, then fear and despair. First, out across fields to Tapper's Corner, and then on footpaths and through an extended stretch of dense trees called Lloyd's Long Woods, Betsy Bailey led her grandson by the hand on a 12-mile trek to his introduction to the realities of slavery. In memory, Douglas used this turning point in his youth for several purposes. He paid tribute to the grandmother he loved, the only family member he could remember in any vivid way. She walked over the Talbot County landscape with the solemnity of a priestess, her bandana turban atop her, marvelously straight, figure elastic and muscular. When the boy tired on his short legs, she carried him on her shoulder like a bushel basket. With the customary riderly detail he had mastered by 1855, he remembered gripping his grandmother's hand tightly, as he imagined some logs and stumps in the dark forest as wild beasts. Most strikingly, Douglas portrayed this childhood memory as an initiation into the separation and abandonment at the heart of slavery. For anyone who has ever watched a lone, shy child of 6 or 7 join a band of other children on a playground, Douglas's poignant recollections of this episode ring true. As his grandmother prepared to leave him forever, she urged him to go play with a group consisting, he soon realized, of six of his cousins and his brother and two sisters, Perry, Sarah, and Eliza. Frederick had never met them. "Brothers and sisters, we were in blood," he wrote, "but slavery had made us strangers." While Frederick stood alone against a wall in confusion, one of the children ran up and shouted, "Fed, Fed, Grandmammy gone." As he ran to look for her, he realized he had been dropped off in a new future, alone. Heartbroken, he remembered falling on the ground as he wept a boy's bitter tears. In this world of children's logic and compensation, his siblings tried to give him peaches and pears, but Frederick flung them away in despair. As he widened his lens and found survival his only option, Douglas turned the childhood recollections of 18 months on the Y plantation into a stunning description of a slave society in microcosm. It was a place of jarring contrasts and brutal contradictions. The Lloyd's massive operation was at once a place 300 years behind the age in all that relates to humanity and morals, but also a thriving business and agricultural enterprise. It was a place with all the sounds and wonders of nature, a scene of almost Eden-like beauty. But also, Douglas said, a dark domain where civilization is shut out, and the people with the power committed all manner of crimes with as much impunity as upon the deck of a pirate ship. In this world of fear and loneliness, but also of endless fascination for a child's boundless curiosity, Douglas burrowed into his interior imagination and found his own ways to be a boy. Historians have made a distinction between societies with slaves and slave societies. In the first, as Ira Berlin has argued, slaves were marginal to the central productive processes, and the master-slave relationship was not the exemplar of life itself. But in a slave society, the master's authority over his bondmen defined all social relations, and all economic production depended intimately on the slave's brawn, brains, and compliance. In a slave society, from dawn until dusk, everyone woke, labored, worried about money or hunger, ate, played, competed, loved, hated, married, worshipped God, sang, dreamed, and died in a world shaped at every turn by slavery. A system in America Douglas once defined succinctly as the granting of that power by which one man exercises and enforces the right of property in the body and soul of another. The Great Y Plantation was all about property. Douglas's memories of the place were one of the deepest roots of his evolving identity, and eventually of his abolitionism. His rich descriptions of the Great House Farm depict a world of both absurdity and joy, of heroic human striving, and of inhumane exploitation and violence. It had a marvel of a windmill to fan a child's imagination, as well as too many frustrated and depraved adults of both races wielding whips with impunity. The plantation seemed a place of permanence with no way out, but it also provided striking, constant views of a wide river with sloops and other sailing boats gliding by on the way to a bay called the Chesapeake and to a city called Baltimore. It had beautiful birds perched in the top of poplar trees, and a scary, haunted graveyard that seemed ancient to the child's eyes. Although surrounded by people, animals, and bustling activity, Frederick was lonely and made no close friends among the younger slaves. He did, however, become close companions with 12-year-old Daniel Lloyd, son of the patriarch of the plantation. Daniel apparently took a liking to Frederick's intelligence and precociousness. Mass Daniel treated Frederick as both servant and playmate. They shared secrets and explored the estate together. They mimicked each other's dialects, and Douglas's testing of his wits and tongue against Daniel's was perhaps the slave boy's first imaginative experience with the wonders of language. He and Daniel may have also shared a good deal of knowledge. The equality of nature is strongly asserted in childhood, Douglas maintained. Daniel could not give his black playmates his company without giving them his intelligence as well. A full-time tutor from New England taught the Lloyd children in a special room to the left of the front portico of the mansion. That room had its own door opening outside. And some days, Frederick waited in the front driveway, as inconspicuously as possible, for Daniel to finish his lessons. This may be where the future Frederick Douglass first sensed the power of what went on in the schoolrooms he could never enter. Throughout his life, especially in early adulthood, Douglass displayed a remarkable hustler's ability to learn, to take and refashion useful knowledge to his own ends, from those around him. He began cultivating this survivor skill at least as early as his romps about the Y plantation with Daniel Lloyd. In afternoon competitive repartee, the future Douglass may have first experimented with the magic of words and unwittingly wielded the tools by which he would invent his life. The Lloyds were perhaps the richest family in Maryland and a slaveholding dynasty. The Georgian Y mansion that Douglass knew and which still stands in full glory, was built by Edward Lloyd IV in about 1785. His son, Edward Lloyd V, long called Governor Lloyd, Douglass knew from a distance. By the 1820s, the combined Lloyd operations had transformed into one of the largest producers of wheat in the United States, as well as a source of massive quantities of corn and pork. Huge flocks of sheep grazed the meadows. The stables were full of saddle and racing horses, a special passion of Lloyd's, and there was plenty of acreage for a private deer park. A beautiful 85-foot-long French provincial orangery, still standing today, with a gentleman's billiards room on the second floor, graced the property 100 yards or so behind the mansion. On the rear of that stunning structure were some attached slave apartments, likely for gardeners, their dark interiors today under archaeological investigation, as they provide a sobering, eye-stopping contrast to the beautiful exterior surroundings. The long, regular slave quarter buildings were a considerable distance from the main house, and largely out of sight to any of the droves of visitors who came for the Lloyds' ostentatious mid-afternoon dinner soirees. Lloyd's wealth, said Douglass in his narrative, was almost equal to the riches of Job. Edward Lloyd V was elected governor of Maryland 3 times and also served in the U.S. Congress. He was as socially well-connected as anyone in the Chesapeake region. Little Frederick would try to peer from a distance or might hear tales from Daniel when as many as 2 dozen overdressed guests would come for the feasts. Douglass described this community of whites and blacks and slaves and free people as a status-ridden universe. Essentially, 3 families resided at the Y plantation. He was part of the kitchen family, consisting of some dozen black children under the tyrannical rule of Aunt Katie. The house family was Aaron Anthony's nuclear family, including his 2 sons and daughter, Lucretia, who married Thomas Auld, the captain of Colonel Lloyd's sloop. The Alds would soon play a crucial role in Frederick's life. Finally, there were the sacred precincts of the great house, including the Lloyds, of course, who lived in splendor, groaning under the weight of their blood-bought luxuries. But the great house also included the Lloyds' 15 house servants, attired in fine clothing, selected for their faithfulness and personal appearance. This plantation, black aristocracy, as Douglass called them, were as remote from him as Colonel Lloyd himself. The house servants resembled the field hands in nothing except in color. It was as though they resided on another planet a few 100 yards away from overseer Captain Anthony's yard. Wearing fine silks and fanning breezes toward the overheated brows of the alabaster ladies, these servants did not even know any of the sorrow and hunger-smitten multitudes of the quarter and the field. Douglass later wrote about this childhood world of beauty and evil, of decadence and mass production, as both his playground and his prison. He did so with astonishing detail, almost all the basics of which can be verified: overseers' names, and many of their terrible deeds of violence, how the field hand's basic food, the ash cake, was baked. This peculiar bread, covered with ashes to the depth of a 16th part of an inch, and how a whip was made entirely of untanned but dried oxhide and painted red, blue, and green before being used on slaves' naked backs. Young Frederick loved horses and the stables, and when allowed, he would hang around them. The stables were run by the father and son pair of slaves, young Barney and old Barney. Any given day might find the half-naked, barefoot boy in his sackcloth shirt, dodging in and out of stalls, gazing at the huge thoroughbreds, admiring with awe the splendid carriages, soft within and lustrous without. Here, Frederick observed the fine functions of saddles and harnesses, and the gigs, phaetons, barouches, sulkies, and sleighs. Douglas possessed an extraordinary memory, and cultivated it endlessly as a rider. By all accounts, and from the evidence of some of his special privileges, the youthful Frederick Bailey was remarkably bright. His powers of observation, active and acute, he impressed those around him as smart and curious beyond his years. The detail of his autobiographies can to some extent be attributed to such sheer intelligence, but other factors were surely as important in his talent for recall. Eventually, the fugitive slave Douglas of 1845 at age 27, as well as the more politically mature and famous Douglas of 1855 at age 37, knew he needed veracity for his story to be creditable in a world that doubted any literary acumen and, for that matter, basic intelligence in blacks. Even more, from his first moments as a speaker in his early 20s, a mere 2 or 3 years out of slavery, Douglas rehearsed over and over the stories he would eventually write up in the narrative and revise in Bondage and Freedom. Memory is a mysterious and infinitely powerful human device, what St. Augustine called a deep and boundless manifoldness and the treasury in the mind. With enough prompts and associations, a great deal of childhood memory, both difficult and pleasing, can be retrieved as it is refashioned. Douglas made as well as received his own story from memory. He summoned it with both private and public repetition for an audience he knew he had to persuade. Self-making is, after all, writes the legal scholar of autobiography Jerome Bruner, our principal means of establishing our own uniqueness. And Douglas had the deepest of reasons to declare his uniqueness. In Bondage and Freedom, in 1855, Douglas disingenuously declares, "Let others philosophize. It is my province here to relate and describe, only allowing myself a word or two to assist the reader in the proper understanding of the facts narrated." Hardly. Douglas's representation of his early life as a slave is a thoroughgoing abolitionist manifesto, a penetrating portrait of the inner and exterior worlds of both slaves and slaveholders. And he may, indeed, have seen or certainly heard a good deal about all that he wrote. An ash cake may be an ash cake, but the blood that flows in what he called his chapter of horrors is full of philosophy as well as psychology, including the beating of his Aunt Hester. Douglas had either witnessed or learned about, from hearsay, at least 7 brutal whippings or murders by the time he was 8. This does not include the casual violence he saw from overseers, from the wretched Aunt Katie around the kitchen, or from his first instructor in religious devotions, a slave named Dr. Isaac Copper, whom Douglas turned into a tragic and comic character in his autobiography. Copper was a cripple who, with hickory switch in hand, forced groups of children to learn the Lord's Prayer, as he also whacked them with his whip. "Everybody in the South," wrote Douglas, "wants the privilege of whipping somebody else. Uncle Isaac shared the common passion of his country." Shortly after memorizing Our Father Who Art in Heaven, Douglas quickly became a truant from Copper's devotions. Details flowed in Douglas's recollections, emanating from pain and adventure tucked away in the secret garden of his memory. His great indictment of slavery came first and foremost from the accumulated injury of his own story. Douglas made a careful study of the range of overseers he had known, from the sadistic to the reluctant to those who enacted violence as mere policy in the slave system. His master, Anthony, seemed to be the company man enforcing policy, except when sexually scorned. Then he joined the darkest side. James Hopkins seemed as good as any man can be and still be an overseer. He whipped slaves with open discomfort. But under Anthony's general command were two other overseers, William Sevier and Orson Gore. Douglas mistakenly identifies him as Austin Gore. These were not names invented by a novelist, but real, hardened, paid accessories to slavery's crimes on the Y plantation. One day, near the slave quarters, Frederick heard noise and screaming. As he sauntered over to the scene, he witnessed Nellie Kellum, a tall, strong slave woman, being wrestled and dragged toward a tree by Sevier. Nellie gave as good as she got in this fight, clawing Sevier's face with her nails and hitting him as hard as he hit her. According to Douglas, three of Nellie's five children witnessed this bloody fracas as Sevier finally subdued Nellie and roped her to a tree. As the children screamed, "Let my mammy go," Sevier shouted foul curses and, like a savage bulldog, beat Nellie to a bloody pulp, while the woman took the blows with fierce and indignant courage. As Douglas wrote of this event years later, he implied that the worst part for him was not Nellie's back, covered with blood, but her screams mingled with those of the children. Such was young Frederick's prolonged initiation into the world of human relationships, to notions of fairness and morality, of crime and punishment, of familial bonds and fissures. Overseers were the law enforcers and the court. Nellie's offense that led to her bloody beating in front of her traumatized children was the ubiquitous slave crime of impudence. The moral Douglas, the abolitionist, drew from this story was that Nellie, as a woman, had stood her ground as long as she could. She left the ugly Sevier scarred in his already deformed face. Her bravery, something Douglas would later claim for himself, proved the doctrine he invoked with excessive bravado. He is whipped oftenest who is whipped easiest. That stirring statement, while manly and inspiring, has the air of smugness, offered from a safer position as author of his memoir many years after watching the slaves on the Y estate live with the frightening daily grind of comprehending just who could muster such courage to resist and who could not. He could hardly offer us, or himself, any sense of what the bleeding Nellie told her sickened children that evening in the quarters. Fighting back was noble and possible, but Douglas also left the distinct impression that in the daily experience of Eastern Shore slavery, even a child began to understand that sanity itself, as well as physical survival, might be at stake. Douglas's litany of experiences with violence went even further. He analyzed the overseers as a distinct class of Southern society. Gore served as the prototype of the cold and calculated tyrant who could instill fear in slaves. He operated not with disgusting swagger and noisy bravado, but with grave and calm self-possession. Gore worked by reputation and action. His power was absolute, and his method, intimidation. He never allowed a slave even to answer back to his orders. Gore worked by the maxim, said Douglas, that it is better that a dozen slaves suffer under the lash without fault than that the master or overseer should seem to have been wrong in the presence of the slave. Gore's words were few but shrill, and the result was sensations of terror among the slaves. "I shunned him," wrote Douglas, "as I would have shunned a rattlesnake." He was still young enough to get away with such avoidance. In Douglas's portrayal, Gore seemed destined for his calling, the perfect creation of slavery itself, the ideal chief of a band of pirates. Gore seemed the perfect colonel in slavery's sick-minded, evil army patrolling the police state. A 20-year-old, robust slave named Bill Denby got into a scrape with Gore. In Douglas's telling of the episode, after a few lashes, Denby ran and plunged into a creek with the water up to his neck. Gore stood on the bank with a shotgun on his shoulder. He gave Denby to a count of three to come out of the water. The belligerent, heroic young man refused, and Gore shot him at point-blank range in the face. Although Douglas admittedly did not witness this killing, he heard about it all over the quarters and wrote about it in dramatic terms. In an instant, poor Denby was numbered with the dead. His mangled body sank out of sight, and only his warm red blood marked the place where he had stood. Gore apparently made his case for a necessary killing to Colonel Lloyd, who gave his approval. No judicial inquiry occurred. Douglas used this case to show that the murder of slaves in Maryland not only remained legal and went unpunished, but that it stood as the terrifying symbol of a society of amoral lawlessness. At the heart of Douglas's autobiographies was the idea that slavery attempted to crush all semblance of natural rights for its victims. A society that sanctioned cold-blooded murder and fostered homicidal madness as necessary steps to social order could only be called by its names, piracy and tyranny. Douglas's later prolific appeals to the natural rights tradition, and even to the right of revolution, should be first considered in light of these compelling, damaging childhood memories of such cruelty. Colonel Lloyd himself, the owner of the great pirate ship, employer of the chief pirate, Gore, in control of the captive deckhands, was hardly above employing the whip. At the stables at the Y Plantation, Douglas observed, a horse was seldom brought out to which no objection could be raised by either Lloyd himself or by his sons and sons-in-law. Old Barney, the head groom and stableman, had to endure these barbs and humiliations. One day, Colonel Lloyd was especially displeased with the appearance of one of his riding horses and took it out on Old Barney. Lloyd ordered the bald and toil-worn man to kneel on the ground and laid 30 lashes with a horsewhip on his bare shoulders. Barney bore it patiently to the last, answering each blow with a slight shrug of the shoulders and a groan. This incident especially shocked Douglas, not, it appears, for the blood drawn, but for the unspeakable humiliation of an old man of dignity and talent by the master himself. The beating of Barney, said Douglas, revealed slavery in its maturity of repulsive hatefulness. In a child's eyes and memories, something sick, frightful, or evil seemed to lurk around the corner of every building, in the sounds of every overseer's steps at the Y Enterprise. Long after he had left the eastern shore behind, such a prospect haunted Douglas. "Such is the constitution of the human mind," Douglas wrote in 1855 while trying to capture his mentality as an 8- and 9-year-old on the Y Plantation, "that when pressed to extremes, it often avails itself of the most opposite ends. Extremes meet in mind as in matter." With a probity unmatched by any other slave narrative author, he remembered and analyzed a world of stark opposites, all but unalterable extremes, that he had to learn to understand, navigate, and survive. As his awareness of his predicament grew, Frederick became a thinking being, trying desperately to preserve and protect his mind as well as his body from internal disintegration and external destruction. At every turn in his life as a slave, both mind and body were in constant danger. His mind, he learned, he could cultivate and protect more easily, with more self-control. Douglas's experiences began to shape a disposition, a set of habits of mind, a personality that may have lasted all of his life. He was forever in search of a sense of home, a concept he dwelled on at length in the autobiographies. He was capable of great love and compassion, but perhaps even more desperately in need of receiving love and compassion long into adulthood. He experienced great difficulty trusting other people, even those who seemed to be friends. With mixed results, he sought time and again to find parental figures in whom to invest his faith and from whom to garner emotional sustenance. And his was a childhood, he admitted, blessed with several turns of good fortune altogether uncommon to slaves, while at the same time, we should not doubt that he carried with him from his youth a profound sense of rage against the violence and degradation he both witnessed and experienced. If a slave was thoughtful and dreamed of something better, Douglas believed, he must endure these extremes. As autobiographer, he ultimately imposed a rather romantic, individualistic, self-made hero on his readers. But crafty and guarded as a writer, he nevertheless revealed a childhood laden with the traumas unique to slavery. Those traumas were a kind of emotional furniture in his psyche. He would forever try to control and rearrange them, but he could never fully expunge them. That emotional furniture may have darkened his outlook, but it also provided the wellspring of his great personal story. Douglas made the nature and history of slavery his youthful inquiry, he maintained. We are led as his readers on the journey of an evolving, brilliant mind's bitter questioning of all around him. Why am I a slave? He asked so innocently in Bondage and Freedom. Why are some people slaves and others masters? He demanded to know, as though representing a child's voice. This subject of my study was with me in the woods and fields, along the shore of the river, and wherever my boyish wanderings led me. Douglas was lucky to enjoy any boyish wanderings as a slave. As autobiographer, he sometimes portrayed himself as just out of the frame of the picture, observing, studying, accumulating the knowledge that might not only free him, but also persuade his audience of the merits of the anti-slavery cause. Long before the age of psychology, Douglas provided a portrait of a young slave conducting psychological warfare against slavery, as that system conspired in every way to ensnare, weaken, and ultimately destroy him. His powers of recollection, fashioned beautifully into words, became his only available weapon. In words, Douglas always fought back, not only to defeat slavery, but to make sense of its extremes and work through his pain. Why am I a slave? Is an existential question that reflects as well as anticipates many others like it in human history. Why am I poor? Why is he so rich and she only his servant or chattel? Why am I hated for my religion, my race, my sexuality, the accident of my birth in this valley or on that side of the river or on this side of the railroad tracks? Why am I a refugee with no home? Why does my color define my life? Douglas's story represents so many others over the ages. Douglas wanted us to believe that as a child he gained inner strength and self-knowledge from his sufferings. With caution, because of his skilled literary invention, we ought not doubt most of what he claimed as an amateur child psychologist. Every student of Douglas tries to discern what, in his memoirist's voice, was real, factual, and what was literary, often a false separation. But the two were almost always mixed for this gifted artist. As we consider the following remarkable passages, who would contest his comprehension of a child's understanding of justice and injustice? As I grew older and more thoughtful, he wrote from the perspective of 1855, I was more and more filled with a sense of my wretchedness. All the cruelty, wrong and outrage he witnessed or learned from others led me, he said, when yet but 8 or 9 years old, to wish I had never been born. I used to contrast my condition with the blackbirds, in whose wild and sweet songs I fancied them so happy. Their apparent joy only deepened the shades of my sorrow. Then he tried to remember how a child's innocent imagination encounters the raw unfairness of the world and the essential venality of humankind. There are thoughtful days, Douglas asserted, in the lives of children, at least there were in mine, when they grapple with all the great primary subjects of knowledge and reach, in a moment, conclusions which no subsequent experience can shake. I was just as well aware of the unjust, unnatural, and murderous character of slavery when 9 years old as I am now. Without any appeal to books, to laws, or to authorities of any kind, it was enough to accept God as a father, to regard slavery as a crime. There is no reason to doubt such an adult observation about a child's instincts. For this young slave, the singing blackbirds did not lie. Douglas's world of extremes flowed from his memory in sheer description as well as in metaphors of explanation. Most of the time, he kept himself squarely within the frame of his canvas. He identified hunger and cold as his primary sufferings at the Y plantation. He spent every day almost in a state of nudity, wearing his tow linen hanging down to his knees. He stayed on the sunny side of the house, or in the corner of the kitchen chimney in winter to find warmth. At the Anthony house, the slave children, like so many pigs, ate cornmeal mush out of a large wooden tray or trough, laid down on the floor of the kitchen or on the ground outdoors. An oyster shell was the only fork or spoon he knew until he moved to Baltimore. He slept in a closet, he tells us. In an extreme cold, he would steal a bag used for carrying corn to the mill, and, with head in and feet out, fitfully sleep on January and February nights. There were no beds or blankets for the slave children. We must imagine Douglas, the 27-year-old writer, sitting at a desk in his small, crowded apartment in Lynn, Massachusetts, in the winter of 1844-45, drafting his first autobiography. As he recollected these physical hardships of his childhood, his feet presumably warm enough, Douglas mingled past and present and announced his suffering and his literacy in one unforgettable metaphor. My feet have been so cracked with the frost that the pen with which I am writing might be laid in the gashes. Memory is almost always a combination of retrieval and invention. The corn sack, a child's frozen feet, and the pen of an adult writer, as a kind of medicinal weapon to cure the gashes in his feet and in his psyche, helped Douglas explain the meaning of being a child slave. Before he parted ways with Y, Douglas did make what he referred to as two friends. One was Daniel Lloyd, to whom he had been designated as playmate and companion. But more important, he was fortunate that Lucretia Auld took a liking to him. Around the Anthony household, with so much that was harsh, Douglas characterized Miss Lucretia, Anthony's daughter and wife of Thomas Auld, as the first white woman who ever bestowed the slightest word or look of kindness upon him. She treated his wounds when he suffered a gash in his forehead in a fight with another boy. She took him into the parlor, a room he had likely never entered, and quietly wiped the blood from his face and applied balsam and white linen to his head. That tender act is the first Douglas remembered from any white person. Lucretia may have pitied me if she did not love me, Douglas remembered. But he imagined and converted it into the love he so craved. She would occasionally give him extra bread, which led the boy to frequently linger, like the hungry dog or cat, beneath her backyard window. He transformed this tenderness into a formal sentence that speaks volumes about his deepest childhood needs. When pretty severely pinched by hunger, I had the habit of singing, which the good lady very soon came to understand as a petition for a piece of bread. I got well paid for my music. Douglas does not recount what tunes or words he sang, but in these simple remembrances, we see the boy who so yearned for love, for belonging, for an adult's embrace, even if it came only in the form of bread and a smile bought for the price of a child's song. Douglas likely heard far more music than he ever sang at the Y Plantation, and on that subject, he left some of his most compelling and complex remembrances. In so doing, he exposed those extremes about which he could not stop thinking. On Allowance Day, at the Great House Farm, when designated slaves from all over the far-flung plantation came to the Y House for their group's allotted monthly provisions, one might have witnessed a spectacle in which the peculiarly excited and noisy slaves gathered for social and musical communion. While on their way, wrote Douglas, they would make the dense old woods, for miles around, reverberate with their wild songs, revealing at once the highest joy and the deepest sadness. Douglas's recollection of these demonstrations of material need and slave culture was both festive and somber. In groups, the wise slaves would compose and sing as they went along, consulting neither time nor tune. The thought that came up came out, if not in word, in the sound. They would sometimes sing the most pathetic sentiment in the most rapturous tone, and the most rapturous sentiment in the most pathetic tone. Embedded in Douglas's memory was the slaves' mixed musical tradition of moans, rhythmic body movement, and improvised lyrics fashioned for specific moments as well as for their visions of eternity. For a long time, he remained both mystified and affected by that music, by the abiding stories he heard, especially in their tone. Slaves on plantations could not own much of anything: land, tools, the clothes on their bodies, even their own children or their sense of a future. But they could, at times, and under certain circumstances, own the sounds and rhythms, the melodies and lyrics in the air, as the great slave-driven machine of the Y Plantation refueled for the next month's production. In his vivid childhood memories, Douglas felt both within and apart from the creation and the meaning of the songs. One gets the impression that the lonely boy may have been both scared by the collective power of the songs and strangely thrilled to be part of the community performing them. Douglas thought that hearing these songs might do more to impress some minds with the horrible character of slavery than the reading of whole volumes of philosophy on the subject. In the original narrative of 1845, he fashioned a stunning memory of which he was so proud that he simply reprinted it in quotation marks with slight revision in the 1855 autobiography. I did not, when a slave, understand the deep meaning of those rude and apparently incoherent songs. They were tones loud, long, and deep. They breathed the prayer and complaint of souls boiling over with the bitterest anguish. The hearing of those wild notes always depressed my spirits and filled me with ineffable sadness. The mere recurrence, even now, afflicts my spirit, and while I am writing these lines, my tears are falling. To those songs, I trace my first glimmering conceptions of the dehumanizing character of slavery. Those songs still follow me to deepen my hatred of slavery and quicken my sympathies for my brethren in bonds. If anyone wishes to be impressed with the soul-killing power of slavery, let him go to Colonel Lloyd's plantation and, on Allowance Day, place himself in the deep pine woods, and there let him, in silence, thoughtfully analyze the sounds that shall pass through the chambers of his soul. In this combination of childhood memory and anti-slavery propaganda, Douglas opened a wide window into his youth as a slave. In his appeal to analyze the sounds, it was as if Douglas left an invitation to modern historians of slavery, to anthropologists and folklorists, as well as to the readers of slave narratives in his own time, to to try to time travel with him to the pine woods around the great oval driveway of the Y House to hear the true meaning of slavery. It was as though he believed that some part of the injustice of enslavement